John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.immc.org, for Tuesday, March 1st, 2011. On Monday, hundreds of Israeli settlers blocked Annapolis Road and dozens more tried to block a main road in Jerusalem, calling for the Israeli government to allow the expansion of a settlement colony located in the North and West Bank. The protest came after a group of settlers tried to expand the settlement of Havat Gilad as the government dismantled the caravan constructed on Palestinian land that the settlers were trying to seize. Angered by the Israeli army for demolishing four homes at the Gilad illegal settlement outpost near the North and West Bank city of Nablus, Israeli settlers carried out several attacks against Palestinians and vowed further attacks in coming days. They said that they marked down several Palestinian targets and that they might also conduct attacks against mosques in the Nablus area. Israeli police arrested on Monday evening 23 settlers who initiated violence during the protest. A group of extremist settlers set fire to a Palestinian home near Nablus Monday night, Palestinian media sources reported. The groups threw Molotov cocktails at houses in Huwara village near Nablus, which set fire to one home that belongs to a resident identified as Rabbi Taha. An Israeli settler hit a Palestinian boy with his car in Hebron on Monday evening. The boy was taken to the Al-Mizan hospital to receive treatment. Medics said the youth sustained moderate wounds. Settler violence continued on Tuesday as settlers attacked several Palestinian neighborhoods in the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Dozens of settlers led by extremist settler leader Baruch Marzel conducted a provocative march in the old city and the area around the Ibrahimi Mosque to protest the evacuation of some homes at an illegal outpost near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Israel has announced plans to legalize a total of 96 settlement outposts. According to Israeli NGO Peace Now, there are a total of 99 settlement outposts, of which the government is planning to dismantle three. However, as part of the same decision, the government is planning to legalize the remaining outposts as they are located on state lands. In Gaza news on Monday, Israeli radio reported that the Israeli army intends to carry out specified and targeted attacks against certain areas in the Gaza Strip without conducting a direct confrontation or ground invasions at the current stage. The attacks will include targeting resistance groups, weapons storage facilities, siege busting, and tunnels in Rafah. Also on Monday, the Israeli army killed a man who entered a 300-meter buffer zone in Gaza. That sums up our news for today. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Huzam Kassis and Ramona M.
Afghanistan yesterday. Six NATO soldiers were killed in multiple attacks. Four were killed in the east, two by one IED, one by another IED, one in an unspecified attack. A fifth was killed in the south. The last soldier, identified by his home country as an Italian, was killed in the west by another IED. Four more Italian soldiers were wounded in that attack. NATO does not release the nationality of those killed in its wars, but most NATO troops now operating in eastern and southern Afghanistan are Americans. This could mean five U.S. soldiers were killed in Afghanistan yesterday, and nobody has said how many more were wounded. Iraq, last week, four members of the U.S. Congress were at a U.S. Army base in Iraq when resistance fighters attacked with rockets. GOP Congressman Mo Brooks, Joe Wilson, Chris Gibson, David Cicilline, and Guam Democrat Madeline Bordello were eating lunch with occupation troops at a military base Wednesday when the base came under rocket attack, Politico reported Friday. No reports have emerged as to which attack on which U.S. base was involved, but David Cicilline appeared in photos taken in Kirkuk. Afghanistan, the 25th of February, Friday night. Insurgents fired two rockets into Bagram Airfield in Kabul, the main U.S. airbase in war-ravaged Afghanistan, amidst a surge in violence against the U.S.-led forces in the country. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid has claimed responsibility for the rocket attack on a U.S. base. Earlier, two rockets targeted central parts of Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, in an attack left no casualties and caused damage to only a few buildings, according to officials. Pakistan. Today, Taliban militants in Pakistan's lawless northwest tribal belt shot and executed four local tribesmen they accused of spying for the U.S., according to officials. Snitches get more than stitches in Pakistan. Diwania, Iraq, Sunday night. Two Katyusha rockets fell on a U.S. Army base known as Camp Echo in southern Iraq's Diwania City, an Iraqi Army source reported. The source added that in the past few days, there have been at least three attacks on U.S. forces in the area, two with Katyusha rockets, and a third with an improvised explosive device that damaged an armored vehicle. Iraq, ongoing. At least 14 people have been killed by security forces as protesters mobilized against corrupt government and lacking public services. Prime Minister Maliki is now calling for early provincial elections, presumably in an attempt to limit calls for replacing the central government. Baghdad, Iraq, Friday. Thousands reportedly participated in a days of rage protest against corruption and shoddy services. Nisan, Iraq, Friday. 27 protesters were wounded in battles with security forces, according to local hospitals. Tikrit, Iraq, Friday. Security forces fired live ammunition at protesters, rather like Gaddafi's thugs in Libya have been doing. A child was shot and killed by these so-called security forces. Nivina, Iraq, Friday. So-called anti-terrorism police opened fire on protesters, again shooting live ammunition. Baji, Iraq, Saturday. One day after security thugs in multiple cities shot at protesters, gunmen attacked Iraq's largest oil refinery, killing a guard, detonating bombs that sparked a fire and forced the facility to shut down, officials reported. There are reports that fuel shortages will now result. Diyala Province, Iraq, today. A Katyusha rocket landed near the U.S. airbase in Al-Saftiya region, northern Bakuba, today at dawn. No report on the damage or casualties. Mr. Barack Obama, now's the time to stop supporting repressive government in Iraq or Afghanistan. Bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me. Ain't going back again.
Those army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
With a slow recovery from the nation's worst recession since the Great Depression, shrinking revenue and federal stimulus money running out, many state governments are struggling to balance their budgets. Some Republican governors are now exploiting the economic shortfall to demand deep cuts in the wages and benefits of state employees, with a few directly attempting to undercut the very power and legitimacy of labor unions. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is among the first GOP politicians to launch what is apparently a coordinated, conservative-led nationwide attack on public employee unions. Although Wisconsin unions have agreed to all of Walker's proposed salary, health insurance, and pension cuts to address a $137 million budget gap, the governor, backed by campaign cash from the right-wing billionaire Koch brothers, won't back down from his primary demand. His goal is to take away public employees' right to collectively bargain with the state. 14 Democratic state senators left Wisconsin February 17th to deny the GOP-controlled Senate a quorum and a vote on the governor's anti-union legislation. Similar showdowns between Republican governors and unions are already underway in Ohio, Indiana, Florida, and Tennessee. In response to the Wisconsin assault on unions, enormous protests in solidarity with public employees have overwhelmed the state capitol in Madison with tens of thousands and as many as 70,000 pro-union demonstrators, marching daily for more than a week. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Zweig, professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. Zweig examines the wider significance of the massive pro-union protests, challenging the Wisconsin governor's effort to slash worker rights.
What we have is a governor backed by the Koch brothers and the Tea Party and the most right-wing elements in the Republican Party pushing to destroy unions. Now, why would they want to do that? Well, they'd want to destroy unions because unions are really the only organizations in this country that have the capacity and the numbers, even as diminished as they are, to put up a credible challenge to the power of the corporations. And, of course, corporations don't want to have any challenge anywhere, so they set about systematically to erode the power of unions. And that's true in the private sector as well as in the public sector. So we've had, over the last 30 years or so, a very dedicated campaign in the private sector to limit what unions can do and to limit the ability of workers to organize. And the result has been great shrinkage of union membership in the private sector. Until now, it's less than 7% of workers in the United States in the private sector are in unions. It's just astounding. It's back to the 1920s. So having chased unions down in the private sector, now the time has come, they think, to destroy unions in the public sector. And that's what we're seeing. And it's plain that this claims about budget deficits and fiscal crises are irrelevant to their plan. In Wisconsin, the governor, when he first came into office, gave tax breaks of $140 million to corporations in the state of Wisconsin. And that increased the deficit, of course, by that amount. And now he's trying to get givebacks from workers of just about the same amount. So it isn't a fiscal question. It isn't a question of what do we do about the deficits, because they're perfectly happy to increase the deficits if it comes to giving money to the wealthy and to the corporations. It's just when it comes time for workers to have their interests met that all of a sudden there's a budget crisis.
Professor Zweig, since the inception of the labor movement, unions have set the standard for wages and benefits for the rest of the population. People who are not unionized benefited from the labor campaign for the 40-hour week, for weekends off, for vacations, for health care benefits, and on and on and on. What's at stake here with this battle in Wisconsin and the other states where the Republican governors are trying to attack the heart and soul of labor organizing?
Well, I think two things are going to result from this attack on the public sector if it works. It's not just a problem for the public sector workers. It's a problem for everybody, because weakening the public sector unions will further weaken the private sector unions, which will drag down the standard of living for working people in general, not just the union workers, because, as you say, unions often set the pattern that non-union employers had to meet, particularly if they didn't want to get a union in their workplace. They would pay their workers the union scale, thinking that that would ward off the union. So if unions can't do that for people, they can't extend better working conditions and better pay, but are constantly on the defensive and constantly losing, it shrinks the capacity of unions everywhere. That's one point. So the other point is, particularly if we're talking about the public sector, if you destroy the teachers' unions and you destroy the unions that represent the police, the firefighters, and the clerical workers and everybody else, what's going to happen is that those workers are going to get laid off. Those workers are going to be treated worse. There are going to be fewer services provided. And that damages everybody, not just the workers in terms of their jobs and their income, but the public in terms of the services that are provided in the parks and in the school districts and in the police and the fire and so on and so forth. It really is an attack on the whole society. And I think finally, in this instance in Wisconsin, there is a flashpoint that people are getting that point and they're really standing up. We'll see how it unfolds.
Do you think the AFL-CIO, and specifically Richard Trumka, was with the United Mine Workers and employed some militant tactics in the field during the Pittston strike back in 1989 and 1990 with some very good results? Do you think we're about to see organized labor in this country take advantage of the spark in Wisconsin to get militant and do their best to educate people in the country who may be skeptical about the value of unions?
Well, I certainly think that this big battle in Wisconsin is really illuminating for people around the country the importance of unions. That brings the question of the legitimacy of unions straight into the focal point. And I think that that is an argument that people are going to have to confront. And we'll see what the labor movement is able to do. And we'll see what, working people in general, not just in unions, are able to do in responding to that question.
That was Michael Zweig, professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York, Stony Brook.
On the 25th of February, over 1,000 supporters of the embattled public service trade unions in Wisconsin gathered in DuPont Circle to denounce Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin and his draconian attempt to break the back of unions by taking away the right of public sector workers to organize a union in Wisconsin. Don't think these problems are only in Wisconsin either. One of the speakers in DuPont Circle spoke of the struggle at Washington Hospital Center, where there's going to be a strike on Friday because the bosses there are trying to do the exact same thing, break the back of the union.
We're all behind them, but I need to let people know that it's not only healthcare and healthcare workers in Wisconsin that are under attack, but healthcare workers right here in the nation's capital. On Friday afternoon, 1600 of my colleagues and I will be walking out of Washington Hospital Center at 6 a.m. We will be staging a one-day strike, and we beg your indulgence to attend and to assist us in our efforts to get in the way of their efforts. The management there, they drafted a Midwesterner, a known and accomplished strikebreaker, to come in. For 8 months, we've been without a contract. Come in and immediately establish and institute their own new terms and conditions in violation of our contract. Boo, boo, boo! To no avail. We were left no option but to call a one-day strike Friday. They will more than likely lock us out for the rest of the week. So at 12 noon at First and Irving Northwest, you can join several thousand of us who will be protesting there against the onslaught of healthcare in general, all of your well-being. For 30-some years, I've been taking care of people just like you. Please come and take care of us on Friday at 12 noon.
Following day, the 26th of February, Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin had the nerve to show up here in D.C. at the J.W. Marriott on 14th Street for the National Governors Association Convention. And there he was confronted by protesters outside, including no less than Governor Shumlin of Vermont, who spoke at the rally himself. There he is.
I just want to say this. You all are the backbone of America. I can do it.
Governor of Vermont, Shumlin.
I think what America wants is thoughtful leaders working together with labor.
That's right.
To make America a better place, to grow jobs and grow our economy and make it a better opportunity for our children. Now, this is what I was suggesting to my friend Governor Walker and others. In Vermont, we know that we get more with maple syrup than we do with vinegar. But I just want to say that not all governors are born the same. And together, we rely upon you, upon labor, upon the ability to collectively bargain, which is a basic human right in a democracy. We're just here to say, keep on keeping on and thinking from the future for America.
Yeah. that night, Sunday night in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin State Police tried and failed to get protesters to leave the Wisconsin State Capitol, which, as this was being recorded, was still under occupation by protesters, insisting it's a so-called budget repair bill that would take that would require annual decertification elections for public employee unions and forbid bargaining over anything other than wages outright, be scrapped. Many people at protests over Wisconsin, in Wisconsin, here in D.C., and everywhere in between have been comparing this struggle to Tunisia and Egypt. Valentine's Day, public housing tenants and supporters showed up outside the Russell Senate office building opposing GOP plans for massive, massive budget cuts for public housing that would throw at least 750,000 people out of the street. I can't imagine anything more likely to destabilize American cities and set up an Egypt-style uprising than throwing so many people out of their homes into the street.
We're not going to take it when the right wing of the Republican House leadership is hijacked by extremists.
That's right.
And it won't be without bad and grave consequences that public housing units won't be preserved. The House Republicans have proposed cutting the public housing preservation program by 40%. And if you don't live in public housing, they're coming after your program tomorrow.
Right.
Is there another federal housing safety net? No. This is our federal housing safety net. We're here to call on the Senate to unequivocally reject the House cuts to public housing, to all housing programs. The House leadership on Friday night suggested to cut the HUD budget by $5.7 billion. These are our communities. These are our neighborhoods. These are our children. These are our grandparents. We say no. We call on the Senate to reject.
Housing, we will fight. We the people have the right. Touch housing, we will fight.
So we all can have somewhere to stay. Because
you cannot put the people in the streets. We need our kids to have somewhere to stay.
Y'all build all these million-dollar stadiums. Y'all do all these things in the community. And people barely have shelter. People have don't have food.
Several speakers went so far as to invoke the Egyptian revolution as an example of what can happen with these kind of cuts.
Egypt and Yemen and happening over there in the Middle East and, you know, in North Africa. And, you know, I'm jealous. I'm jealous.
So how come this Congress right here, they always find money for war? We're spending $320 billion every day on a war in Afghanistan that we can't even win. Do with that $320 million for housing for people who need homes.
Yes. Education.
Money for housing, not for war. That is what we're fighting for. Money for housing, not for war. That is what we're fighting for. Money for housing, not for war. That is what we're fighting for.
A lot of people waiting to go in and talk to some of these members of Congress about the housing issues. If John Boehner and the Republicans get their way and the government shuts down in 3 days, we could be looking at Wisconsin everywhere next week.
Head rock, Jared Ball, DJ Munch, Chocolate City, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Thumping.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over
piss.
Walmart?
It's infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than their male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart?
It's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister. Strom Thurmond, similar. Confederate state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee a plantation mentality. Results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they want to come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
The 15th of February, ANC Single Member District 6CO1 held a public meeting on the subject of Walmart coming to D.C., in particular on the subject of the New Jersey Avenue location. Yes, it's appropriate the meeting is being held in church, considering we're talking about a corporation that's trying to turn the whole city into an economic hell.
I am a member of, community member of the single member district. I am currently unemployed, and would I want a Walmart job? No, because I left UCPS unemployed back in June of 2009. Back in 2009, and even the wage they were paying me wasn't a livable wage. I live in affordable housing, and I know what it is to basically just pay bills and just make ends meet. Basically, the paycheck Walmart will give them will go back to Walmart. So who is truly benefiting? I have an aunt in South Carolina works for Walmart, and trust me, full time. And guess who covers her? Her ex-husband still carries her on his insurance, her and her two sons. So I know a thing or two about Walmart.
Hey, everyone. My name is Asantua Intuma Ture. I'm a member of the Keep DC Walmart Free Community Coalition. I'm also a member of Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ, Reverend Raylan Hagler, Senior Pastor. I want to say less than 4 minutes. First of all, I think the most important thing for us to understand about Walmart is we need to be informed and educated about what it means. Okay? To that extent, I have some flyers here about a movie called Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price.
Yep.
It'll be shown this Friday at Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ at 6:30 p.m. The church is located at 5301 North Capitol Street, Northeast. All right, so make sure you learn these flyers. Secondly, we are working on several things to educate the community about Walmart and the invasion of Walmart and the danger that it proposes to this city, across the city. To that extent, we're working on inviting a woman to come speak here in Washington, D.C.
She's the author of a book called Selling Women Short, The Landmark Battle for Women Workers' Rights at Walmart, Lisa Featherstone. Also working on bringing a woman to D.C. named Reverend Betty Duke. Remember that name, Reverend Betty Duke, Pittsburgh, California. She is the original lead plaintiff in the lawsuit against Walmart for gender discrimination, the largest class action lawsuit in the history of this country. Reverend Betty Duke began working for Walmart back in the 1990s, and she was discriminated against. In this book, the author talks about Reverend Betty Duke and some other women and what has happened to them over the years. We need to understand what it means to have more than 1 million women for over a 15-year period to suffer different types of discrimination based on gender in terms of pay, denied promotion, etc. We need to know what that means. Secondly, we need to know what it means when you can go to Walmart and pay $2 for a five-pound bag of potatoes or $1 for a pound of carrots, but yet the community around you has been destroyed in terms of gentrification and all that means. It makes no difference to me if I can go to Walmart and pay $2 for a pound of potatoes if I can no longer afford to live in my community because I've been forced out. I don't want to crawl over my neighbors who own their own business and they've been there all their lives and they have to close because Walmart now unfairly undercuts their prices. We need to know what that means. Lastly, and with all due respect for the organizations here who talked about Walmart and how they want to bring Walmart in, with all due respect, the reason why Walmart is so controversial is because they make billions of dollars.
Yep.
By underpaying their employees, by forcing people to work off the clock, by forcing to work overnight or late at night. We need to ask questions. We need to know what kind of questions to ask. Okay? Lastly, let me make this real quickly. For the groups that here that are supporting Walmart or supporting the developer of Walmart, Walmart is notorious for buying friends.
Ooh.
I'm going to be real clear, we're in the house of God. All right? I don't want to pay $5 for a shirt and destroy my neighbor's livelihood. If that's not illegal, at least I know it's immoral, according to my Bible.
Ooh.
Somebody say amen.
Amen. Amen.
Now, in one year, they're putting in 80,000 square feet of space on the second floor. Why in the world would you want to put your space on the second floor when first floor is a fine area? I don't know, beats me. It sounds really good that first floor, 80,000 square feet, divided by maybe 22,000, 3,000 square feet to attract house, retailers and restaurants, but I don't know that many retailers or businesses will survive with having Walmart up there. So my guess is, it's just my guess, you may disagree, but if you can't find any tenants to occupy those first level of 80,000 square feet, Walmart have a very justifiable answer to say, hey look, we try to make this into a place where where people could shop and enjoy all day, but it didn't work. So rather than leaving it empty. So that makes the store 160,000 square feet, which would be very close to their prototype of suburban bar.
Is that when they bring in the guns?
I mean, totally one bar.
I don't know if you guys know where my store is. It's on East Capitol, 4th Street. But it's a great neighborhood. People say, I won't be affected, but Walmart's 1 mile away. It's like Harris Teeter King. Less than 1 mile, they said I wouldn't be affected, my business went down. Imagine what Walmart would do when it actually pops up. My business will definitely go down, the money that I actually put into it, I can't sell and lose. So I'm very scared, so please take an effect. When you bring in a Walmart, what it does to a lot of the mom and pop stores, a lot of these people work night and day, 7 days a week, 14, 15 hours a day, 16 hours a day, putting their life in to make money to survive. You bring in something like that, it's going to wipe them out. And I thank you for this.
On the 25th of February, animal rights activists showed up at both the offices and the homes of executives associated with AstraZeneca and other Huntington Life Sciences customers. Huntington Life Sciences is a contract animal testing laboratory where undercover investigators have caught so-called researchers punching beagles in the face, dissecting live monkeys, and even falsifying test results.
AstraZeneca executives, for the animals we will fight!
We are going to sleep at night.
AstraZeneca executives, for the animals we will fight!
We are going to sleep at night.
For the animals we will fight!
We are going to sleep at night.
AstraZeneca executives, for the cat and for the mouse!
We are coming to your house.
For the beagle, for the mouse!
We are coming to your house.
For the private, for the mouse!
We are coming to your house.
For the beagle, for the mouse!
We are coming to your house.
AstraZeneca!
It sure didn't take long for protesters who made that promise at AstraZeneca's downtown D.C. offices to show up at the home of Brian Maloney, the Associate Director for Policy and Issues Management of AstraZeneca. Brian Maloney lives in a huge apartment building, so instead of sitting out front with bullhorns, protesters entered the building and gave out flyers to apartments all over. I believe it was about six floors of the building. And you can bet he had a lot of explaining to do the next day to all his neighbors about why they got flyers under their doors or under door knockers saying, quote, Brian Maloney and AstraZeneca is responsible for this, and showing a chopped up dead beagle puppy covered in blood from inside Huntington Life Sciences. Next, protesters showed up at the home of Mark Coyne, Director of Global Policy for Huntington Life Sciences customer Baxter, and he formerly also worked for AstraZeneca, the primarily targeted Huntington Life Sciences customer of the weekend. Outside his house, they brought out the bullhorn, simply to tell all the neighbors what Mark Coyne's been doing.
Good evening, residents of S Street. And we just wanted to let you know that this is a community award that your neighbor at 1006 S Street, apartment B, is a publicly scumbag. His name is Mark Coyne, and he is the director of global government policy for Baxter. Baxter is a top customer of Huntington Life Sciences. Once again, your neighbor at 1006 S Street, Mark Coyne, is a puppy killer that contracts with Huntington Life Sciences. This is a neighborhood alert. Your neighbor at 1006 S Street, contracts with animal testing facility Huntington Life Sciences. He is responsible for the deaths of over 500 animals each and every day of the week. If you have animal companions, please walk across this house with caution, because he might kidnap your dogs and put them inside Huntington Life Sciences. This is a neighborhood community alert. Your neighbor, Mark Coyne, is a puppy killer.
One of the neighbors remarked, Mark Coyne's really not all that popular. He's mean to animals, and he has a dog that he never walks himself. AstraZeneca, Baxter, Bayer, Nofia Venice, all of you know what you need to do. You don't want protesters coming to your homes. Dump Huntington Life Sciences. Stop sending business to companies that torture animals to death.